Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everybody. Well, today's Tuesday. It's October 27th, 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard. My name is Hezzy Eris. I'm your host today. But it's just going to be you and I for the day during our broadcast. We don't have any guests because we just didn't have to put the time to put it all together for today. And it gives us an opportunity to catch up on a lot of stuff that we haven't been able to catch up to during the week. So the first thing you should note is that while I'm reading you the news, I can't look at the studio screen. So if you're listening to me on a report and you're hearing this section, after I finish a particular issue, I'll be coming back to the studio screen just to check to see if anybody's online. And if so, then we'll pick them up. Otherwise, we'll continue with the different articles that have been prepared. Okay, so I guess the first thing we should do is just look to see what's happening on the local scene. And there are a couple of things. Today at 12 o'clock, which I won't be able to attend, there will be a demonstration that will inform the public that there is going to be a battle with the corporate giant UPS, and it's going to move to the court. So the press conference is going to take place at 12 noon at the UPS facility, which is at 555 Tuckahoe Road. That's Yonkers, New York. Zip code is 10710, and it'll be in before the front entrance. So local homeowners in Yonkers are going to be represented by attorney Joel Sachs of the White Plains law firm of Keene and Bean, PC, who have filed an Article 78 proceeding in Westchester County Supreme Court. Well, the petitioners include the Grassy Sprain Civic Association, Sprain Lake Knowles Civic Association, and Winchester Homeowners Association. And they all will, that represents several hundred households in close proximity to the site. Roman Kozitsky, a chairman of the Yonkers Planning Board, and Vincent Peachy, the commissioner of housing and buildings, a UPS, a tenant of the site at 550 Tuckahoe Road, owned by Alfred Newman, Weissman, rather, of Weissman Real Estate, LLC. And its subsidiaries are all going to be engaged in this suit. So that's going to be very, very compelling. On another issue, which is really quite important, and it's something that came to light from Greenberg Town Supervisor Paul Feiner. And he wrote an article in which he states that the New York State Board of Elections are authorizing more, he's asking the New York State Board of Elections to authorize more voting hours to reduce lines. So he writes that the Westchester County Board of Elections co-executive director Bob Bream needs to have longer hours, more staff at the Greenberg voting locations as well. And he suggests that, or he informs us that 2, 3, even 4.5 hour waits for voting is excessive and not reasonable. Points out that Greenberg is looking for volunteer entertainers this weekend to make the wait better. Also, he's got a suggestion, have 1 hour earlier voting hour for the disabled and frail elderly. And although the town of Greenberg has no control over the election process, Westchester County Board of Elections oversees the elections, and we are trying hard to make the election process less stressful for voters who have been waiting online for long periods of time. So he advises that we are, quote, one, live streaming the Greenberg Town Hall voting location so you'll have a better idea when to vote. 2, he's offering outdoor flu shots to voters waiting online, courtesy of the Greenberg Health Center. 3, he's arranged for food trucks to be at town hall parking area so hungry voters waiting in line can purchase food and drink. He's created a senior citizen line specifically, and he's created priority lines for the disabled and very frail elderly, and they go first, he says. I think the town is doing more than most communities to make the voting experience a less aggravating experience. And he says he hopes to have entertainment this weekend from volunteer musicians, yoga instructors. He asks if you want to volunteer to direct email to jbeville, B-E-V-I-L-L-E, at greenbergnewyork.com, or to Paul Feiner, P-F-E-I-N-E-R, at greenbergny.com. And we're talking about Judith Bell, Beville, and Greenberg Town, who is the Greenberg Town Clerk. And he says that she's also an outstanding events coordinator. She knows how to party. And if voters are going to vote for the candidate who represents the party of their choice, the voters might want to also party while voting for their party. So the lines are very long, 2, 3, 4.5 hours. And this weekend, over 4.5 hours for some voters, which is outrageous. Feiner says that he's been complaining and received the following email from the New York State Board of Elections, authorizing the Westchester County Board of Elections to increase hours of operation. So he's got a suggestion. He says, I think that the Westchester County Board of Elections should have an earlier voting hour specifically for and only for the disabled and frail elderly. It should be scheduled before the polling place is open to everyone. The voting booths are cleaner at the beginning of voting hours. Those with medical conditions would be safer if they have less contact with lots of other people during the COVID-19 epidemic. And he writes that correspondence from the New York State Board of Elections to local Board of Elections in response to higher voter turnout during early voting is covered and expressed by a ruling, which is 9 NYCRR 6210.19D1, which says if the voter waiting time at an early voting site exceeds 30 minutes, the Board of Elections shall deploy such additional voting equipment, election workers, and other resources necessary to reduce the wait time to less than 30 minutes as soon as possible, but no later than the beginning of the next day of early voting. And while the current voter enthusiasm is higher than anticipated, boards with voter wait times exceeding 30 minutes must work to come into compliance with the early voting wait time standard. In addition, it says boards may decide on a bipartisan basis to provide additional staff, voter sign-in stations, and or increase the early voting hours to meet the added demand. Then there's another election law, subsection 8-600, then in parentheses 4, in parentheses D, which provides 1. Nothing in this section shall be construed to prohibit any Board of Elections from establishing a greater number of hours for voting during the early voting period beyond the number of hours required in this subdivision. And any expansion of hours would need to be provided uniformly at all polling sites in your county. So if you have more information or you have more interest or questions, rather, you should contact the office, Bob Brehm, B-R-E-H-M, or Robert A. Brehm. He's the co-executive director of the New York State Board of Elections. And so contact information is there. And also as a reminder, he points out, Supervisor Paul Feiner says, the failure to break up boxes when they go through the process of recycling really slows up the Department of Public Works crews to make multiple trips to pick up cardboard boxes. She says this is costly, and he asks people to please break your boxes and flatten them on paper recycling day. And he's got a YouTube connection there, so you could actually see why it makes so much sense. Okay, so that was really important to get out of the way. And bear with me one moment. I want to just make sure if there's anything else that was really quite pertinent that you might find interesting on the very local market. I want to make sure if we cover this or not. No, I think that's it. Yeah, and you could always go to the YonkersTribune.com website to get more information. There's a lot of new news on the front page. And then, of course, you can move down and you can see some of the other stuff that's happened in the last week as well. So in different sections, I think you'll find that interesting. Okay, so let's move on to different issues now. This is very interesting. If you haven't heard, it happened last night. The Senate has confirmed Amy Coney Barrett to the United States Supreme Court in a victory for the Republicans. Well, it turns out that the Republican-controlled U.S. Senate handed President Donald Trump a major pre-election political victory on Monday by confirming his Supreme Court nominee, Amy Coney Barrett, with the White House planning a celebratory event afterward. Senate voted 52-48. With Democrats unified in opposing Barrett's confirmation, which creates a 6-3 conservative majority on the high court. And one Republican, Susan Collins, voted against the confirmation. The ceremony planned at the White House comes a month after a similar event was linked to a COVID-19 outbreak that preceded Trump's own infection. Barrett will succeed liberal Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who died last month. Barrett's appointment is a huge win for Donald Trump ahead of the election. At the ceremony, conservative Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas will administer one of the two oaths of office the justices have to take, according to a White House official. Chief Justice John Roberts will administer the separate judicial oath at the court on Tuesday. The court said in a statement, Trump pressed the Senate to confirm Barrett, who's 48, to the lifetime post for the November 3rd election, which would create a 63 conservative majority on the top U.S. judicial body. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer said that the Republican majority was, quote, lighting its credibility on fire, end quote, by proceeding with a vote so close to the election after blocking Democratic President Barack Obama's election year nominee in 2016. Truth is, this nomination is part of a decades-long effort to tilt the judiciary to the far right, he added. Republican Majority Leader Mitch McConnell defended Barrett's nomination. We don't have any doubt, do we, that if the shoe was on the other foot, they'd be confirming, McConnell said, and you can't win them all, and the elections have consequences. No nominee to the Supreme Court has ever been confirmed by the Senate this close to the presidential election, and Trump has been touting the appointment at campaign rallies to the cheers of his supporters. And Trump has said he expects the court to decide the outcome of the election between him and Democrat Joe Biden, and wants Barrett to participate on any election-related case that goes before the justices. Barrett, a federal appeals court judge, is Trump's third selection for the court, enabling him to remake it in dramatic fashion as part of his success in moving the broader federal judiciary to the right since taking office in 2017. Barrett is expected to participate in arguments on November 10 in a case in which Trump and Republican-led states are seeking to invalidate the Affordable Care Act. The 2010 health care law, also known as Obamacare, has helped millions of Americans obtain medical insurance and barred private insurers from denying medical coverage to people with pre-existing conditions. Barrett has criticized previous rulings upholding Obamacare, but said during her confirmation hearing she had no agenda to invalidate the measure. During her confirmation hearing before the Senate Judiciary Committee 2 weeks ago, Barrett, a favorite of Christian conservative, irked Democrats by sidestepping questions on abortion, presidential power, climate change, voting rights, Obamacare, and other issues. On September 26th, a Rose Garden ceremony at which Trump named Barrett as his nominee preceded a wave of COVID-19 cases among top Republicans, including Trump and First Lady Melania Trump. The president spent 3 nights hospitalized receiving COVID-19 treatment. And the event, part of which occurred in the White House Rose Garden, was crowded with guests, many of whom did not wear masks. White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows told reporters that Monday's event likely would be held outdoors. Tonight, we'll be doing the best we can to encourage as much social distancing possible, Meadows had said. And Senator Kevin Cramer, a Republican and Trump ally, said he was not overly concerned about attending the White House event. So bear with me a moment here. Okay. All right. So, I think and several other Republican senators said they were not sure they would attend, and McConnell did not reply when asked by a reporter earlier this month. McConnell said he had not been at the White House since August because of its handling of COVID-19 precautions. All right. So that seems to be like a major, major concern, of course, for us. And then we have, we told you about this yesterday. There was a call by Turkey to resist. Well, actually, Turkey called for a boycott of French firms. And French firms were urged to resist the blackmail as Turkey's Erdogan joins the call for the boycott. So economists have downplayed the threat to French exports as calls to boycott French goods spread across the Muslim world in a backlash over the hardened stance France has taken against radical Islamists in the wake of the brutal murder of a teacher. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan became the first head of state on Monday to join calls for a boycott that has seen French goods being pulled from supermarket shelves in Qatar and Kuwait, among other Gulf states. Never give credit to French-labeled goods. Don't buy them, Erdogan said in a televised speech in Ankara, further ratcheting up his criticism of French President Emmanuel Macron. The backlash stemmed from comments made by Macron after the October 16 beheading of a history teacher who had shown cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad in a class discussion on free speech. Depictions of the Prophet Muhammad are forbidden in Islam and are offensive to many Muslims. In the wake of Samuel Paty's gruesome murder, the French president vowed to take the fight to Islamists, saying that France would not give up the right to caricature. He vowed that France would never give up the right to lampoon political and religious figures. He doubled down on his defense of French secularism in the wake of the teacher's beheading, and his government has vowed to crack down on mosques and Muslim organizations suspected of spreading hate speech. Macron's comments triggered protests in several Muslim-majority countries at the weekend, with people burning pictures of Macron in Syria and setting fire to French flags in the Libyan capital of Tripoli. Seeking to calm the current backlash against France, the French Council of the Muslim Faith said on Monday that Muslims are not persecuted in France and freely practice their religion. But some in Western Europe's largest Muslim community warned that Macron's words risk further alienating a segment of the population that already feels discriminated against. the head of France's MEDEF Employers Federation on Monday said that the boycott, which he described as foolishness, was clearly bad news for companies already hit hard by the coronavirus pandemic. But there is no question of giving in to blackmail, Jeffrey Roux de Bézieux told reporters or broadcaster RMC. It is a question of sticking to our Republican values. There is a time to put principles above business. He said MEDEF supported the government's stance and urged companies to resist this blackmail and unfortunately to endure this boycott, which he said remained fairly localized for now. The French Foreign Ministry has urged Middle Eastern countries to prevent the boycott, saying that the baseless calls are being pushed by a radical minority. And French Trade Minister Frank Riester told reporters on Monday that the government was not planning a reciprocal boycott against Turkish products. Boycotts are likely to have only a marginal impact on French exports, said French economist Stéphanie Vielle, noting that tariffs on French wine introduced by the United States last year were far more crippling. If there was a real intent to hurt France's economy, then all French products would be boycotted, Vielle told RTL Radio, citing the more lucrative aviation and luxury sectors, which have not been affected. Well, arms exports account for the lion's share of French trade with countries like Qatar and Kuwait, said Frédéric Ancel, a professor of geopolitics at the Paris Business School. And such contacts take years to negotiate. He told French daily Le Parisien. No mosque or non-governmental organization can halt the sale of French bombers or Rafale fighter jets. Describing the boycott as a micro-phenomenon, Ancel said that Middle Eastern countries would also be reluctant to provoke retaliatory action by France's European partners. Economic reasons, governments will ensure the protest action remain marginal, Ancel told Le Parisien, the newspaper. He's added for most Muslim countries, the European Union is a more important trade partner than China, the United States, or India. They cannot risk incurring sanctions from their principal trading partner. As the backlash against France widens, European leaders have rallied behind the French president and slammed Erdogan's attacks on Macron. They are defamatory comments that are completely unacceptable, particularly against the backdrop of the horrific murder of the French teacher Samuel Paty by an Islamist fanatic. German Chancellor Angela Merkel's spokesman, Stefan Seibert, had told reporters on Monday. Well, the prime ministers of Italy, the Netherlands, and Greece also expressed support for France, as did European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen, who happens to be German. President Erdogan's words addressing President at Emmanuel Macron are unacceptable. Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte tweeted, adding that the Netherlands stood for the freedom of speech and against extremism and radicalism. Italy's Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte tweeted, quote, "Personal insults don't help the positive agenda the European Union wants to have with Turkey, but pushes solutions further away." Erdogan is not the only head of state to have admonished France and its president for allegedly offending Muslims. In a series of tweets posted on Sunday, Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan accused Macron of attacking Islam clearly without having any understanding of it. Khan added, quote, "President Macron has attacked and hurt the sentiment of millions of Muslims in Europe and across the world." Well, earlier this month, before Paty's murder in a Paris suburb, Macron unveiled a plan to fight what he called Islamist separatism in France. He stressed that he was referring to radical Islamism and not Muslims in general, though he also argued that Islam was, quote, "in crisis everywhere in the world." Okay. So, very, very pertinent stuff. Let me quickly look at our studio screen before we continue. Bear with me a moment. Okay, we seem to be fine here. This is very interesting because I don't know if people recognize it, but there is an Armenian diaspora and they're pitching in the Nagorno-Karabakh truce, which has crumbled. Well, bear with me a second. One second here. Okay. Well, in abandoned mountain villages and small towns shattered by shelling in Nagorno-Karabakh, soldiers fighting in the disputed enclave since the war between Armenia and Azerbaijan broke out last month. They include local Armenian residents called up to serve on the front line, as well as members of the Armenian diaspora from countries such as France doing what they can to support their homeland. As renewed fighting this week put a U.S.-backed ceasefire in Nagorno-Karabakh in jeopardy, reservists and volunteers from the vast Armenian diaspora are determined to support their homeland. In the Maturni district of the mountainous enclave pockmarked by the scars of war, local reservists recounted how their lives changed overnight. 3 weeks ago, life was peaceful. Everyone was busy with their own jobs, said one soldier. But then the fighting began. There was no question about answering the call to military service, including for some French citizens of Armenian origin. We left hoping to help with the war, if not in active military service, then in some other way, not necessarily by going to the front and carrying a weapon, because all Armenian people, the whole country is involved, explained Sipan Mouradian, a 28-year-old French national. So it's getting tougher and tougher, and more people are going to become involved, and it's going to be a mess, that's for sure. Now let's look at what else is going on. The Belarus workers and the students have started a nationwide strike in a new challenge to the government of Lukashenko. Well, it seems that Belarusian opposition leader Svetlana Tikhanovskaya called for a nationwide strike to start on Monday to push for President Alexander Lukashenko's resignation, but the opposition is up against economic pressure and police violence. Well, factory workers and students took to the streets on Monday as the Belarusian opposition started strike action against Lukashenko's regime, which has ruled Belarus for 26 years. A few workers at the Minsk tractor factory wanted to discussed strike action. However, one worker there taking industrial action, Oleg was his name, he wouldn't give his last, said that the 80% of workers here are against the regime, but they're afraid. We don't have a proper trade union, Oleg continued. The only union we do have backs the president. Said so far, said Stas, a student protesting in Minsk. Anything can happen. It's scary, very scary, he says. But another student, Katya, that's a woman's name, said, it's not as scary as the idea of living under this government for years to come. So that is the gist of it, in juxtaposition to one thought, that is the other. Now, the response in Italy with regard to measures to stop the COVID-19 spread has brought out a lot of protesters and over police measures. Well, thousands of Italian protesters, angry over new restrictions, announced to control the spread of the coronavirus, clashed with police in cities on Monday as European governments toughened their responses to the contagion. Following weekend demonstrations that saw violence in Italy, crowds ranging in size from several hundred to several thousand took to the streets again on Monday evening. In Milan, several trams were vandalized and bins were set on fire, while anti-riot police fired tear gas at groups of young people throwing glass bottles and other projectiles, with similar scenes found in neighboring Turin, the capital, the northern capital, and in southern Naples as well. The scenes of unrest came from Italian Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte, who ordered restaurants and bars to shut before 6 p.m., while theaters, cinemas, and gyms were ordered closed for a month, much to the annoyance of business owners, opposition politicians, and even some scientists. Violence in Italy, which imposed one of the toughest lockdowns in the first wave of infections in March and April, is likely to reverberate around Europe, where governments are weighing the need for tougher measures against the fatigue and frustration felt by many. There's no question that the European region is an epicenter of disease right now, World Health Organization Emergencies Chief Michael Ryan said on Monday. Maria van Kerkhove, the World Health Organization's technical expert on the pandemic, also voiced concern about the situation in Europe, and in particular a surge in hospitalizations and rapidly filling intensive care units. In many cities, we're seeing beds filled up too quickly, and we're seeing many projections saying the intensive care units, the ICU beds, which reach a capacity, will reach capacity in the coming days and weeks, she told Monday's briefing. Well, the Czech Republic said it would impose a nighttime curfew, mimicking measures already introduced in France and Spain. Slovenia imposed border closures, while even Norway, one of Europe's lowest infection rates, tightened its rules on social gatherings on Monday. France is also bracing for harsher measures, with President Emmanuel Macron set to gather his top ministers Tuesday to review efforts to curtail the outbreak after the number of daily cases topped 50,000 for the first time at the weekend. Some options reportedly being considered included weekend lockdowns in high infection areas, an earlier nighttime curfew, or even another general countrywide stay-at-home order. COVID-19 has now claimed the lives of 1.1 million people and infected more than 43 million globally. Well, the economic fallout continues to be severe, with tens of millions losing jobs and economies tanking across the world and politicians struggling to find answers. U.S. President Donald Trump, with his reelection campaign in full swing, was once again on the back foot after one of his senior officials suggested his government would not control the virus, comments seized by the challenger Joe Biden. "We're absolutely rounding the corner," said Trump, denying he was giving up on the virus fight, even as his country smashed its own dismal record for new daily cases on the weekend. World Health Organization's chief Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus warned that giving up on control of the pandemic was dangerous. Wall Street had its worst session in weeks on Monday, driven by spiking virus cases globally that would mean new business strangling containment measures, as well as the worsening prospect of new stimulus for the U.S. economy. And despite months of arduous talks, there appears to be little chance that Republicans and Democrats will hammer out a rescue deal to help cash-strapped Americans before the November 3rd election, with both sides blaming the other for the impasse. In Italy, Prime Minister Conte told citizens on Monday that he hoped the new restrictions, quote, will allow us to be more relaxed by Christmas, end quote, but warned that hugging and partying would remain out of the question. The newspaper poked fun at the Prime Minister with Corriere della Sera's front page featuring a cartoon of Conte telling Father Christmas, "Stop, we brought in a decree to save you." Well, but restaurants and bar owners are not laughing. The early closing times mean Italy's bustling aperitivo hour is gone, as are dinners out. And Italy's foremost film director wrote an open letter warning that by closing cinemas, the measures risk jeopardizing the future of an entire sector. And Italian conductor Riccardo Muti said that the move would harm people's health. Far-right opposition leader Matteo Salvini said he was preparing a legal challenge, but the World Health Organization advisor to Rome, Walter Ricciardi, said the new rules may, quote, not be enough, end quote, to stop the virus. Street violence in Italy was mirrored in Nigeria, where crowds ransacked warehouses in the capital of Abuja, where they carted off supplies earmarked for distribution during the coronavirus lockdowns. We are hungry, you understand, a man with a package of noodles in his hand advised. We are not stealing, it's our food and our right. Australia provided a small dose of good news on Monday, with the second city of Melbourne registering no daily cases and preparing to exit one of the world's most severe lockdowns. The city's residents have been under stay-at-home orders for nearly 4 months, but with new cases falling dramatically, the state's politicians have been under pressure to lift the measures. So we'll have to see how all that moves about. One second. Well, there are over tens of thousands have called for the French boycott in Bangladesh over the caricatures of the Prophet. Well, tens of thousands of protesters marched through the Bangladeshi capital on Tuesday, calling for a boycott of French products and burning an effigy of President Emmanuel Macron after he defended cartoons depicting the Prophet Muhammad. Well, police estimated that more than 40,000 people took part in the march, organized by an Islamist party, which was halted before it could get close to the French embassy in Dhaka. Well, hundreds of officers used a barbed wire barricade to stop the protesters, who broke up without violence. French leader has been the target of protests in several countries over his comments made after a teacher was decapitated for showing the cartoons to his pupils. Well, the rally was organized by Islami Andolan Bangladesh, IAB, one of the country's largest Islamist parties, and shared at Bangladesh, .com. So that's going to be very, very interesting how all this goes. One second. Well, the rally was organized by Islami Andolan Bangladesh, IAB. It's one of the country's largest Islamist parties and started at Bangladesh's biggest mosque. Protesters chanted boycott French products and called for Macron to be punished. Macron is one of the few leaders who worship Satan, Atal Rahman, a senior Islami Andalon member, told the rally at the Baitul Mukarram National Mosque. Rahman called up the Bangladesh government to, quote, kick out the French ambassador, while another leader, Hassan Jamal, said that activists would tear down every brick of that building if the envoy was not ordered out. France is the enemy of Muslims. Those who represent them are also our enemies, said Nassar Uddin, a young leader of the group. Even after the rally, it was halted. Demonstrators marched down other streets chanting boycott France and Macron will pay a high price. French president's comments on Islam have already led to a diplomatic showdown with Turkey. Macron said that the school teacher was killed because Islamists want our future. Okay, so a lot of stuff is going on all over the place. This is interesting, talking about COVID-19. There's a UK study which has found evidence that the COVID-19 antibodies may not be long-lasting. So, antibodies against the novel coronavirus declined rapidly in the British population during the summer, a study found on Tuesday, suggesting protection after infection may not be long-lasting and raising the prospect of waning immunity in the community. Scientists at Imperial College London have tracked antibody levels in the British population following the first wave of COVID-19 infections in March and April. Their study found that antibody prevalence fell from 6% of the population around the end of June and July, and it's just 4.4% in September. And that raises the prospect of decreasing population immunity ahead of a second wave of infections that has forced local lockdowns and restrictions in recent weeks. Although immunity to the novel coronavirus is a complex and murky area and may be assisted by T cells as well as B cells that can stimulate the quick production of antibodies following re-exposure to the virus, the researchers said that the experience of local combinations approach immunity might not be enduring. Well, we could see the antibodies and we could see them declining, and we know that antibodies on their own are quite protective. Wendy Barclay, head of the Department of Infectious Disease at Imperial College London, told reporters, quote, on the balance of evidence, I would say that with what we know of other coronaviruses, it would be ridiculous, to think that it wasn't happening. My goodness. So that became like a major, major concern. Let's quickly look and see what else is out there that you may find interesting. And one second. This was really unexpected, certainly by me. I didn't remember that we found water on the moon. But evidently we did. Evidently the moon is richer in water than once thought. Seems there may be far more water on the moon than previously thought, according to two studies published on Monday, raising the tantalizing prospect that astronauts on future space missions could find refreshments and maybe even fuel on the lunar planet. Or on the lunar surface. Well, the moon was believed to be bone dry until around a decade ago, when a series of findings suggested that our nearest celestial neighbor has traces of water trapped in the surface. Two new studies published in Nature Astronomy on Monday suggest there could be much more water than previously thought, including ice stored in permanently shadowed cold traps at lunar polar regions. Well, previous research has found indications of water by scanning the surface, but these were unable to distinguish between water, H2O, and hydroxyl, a molecule made up of one hydrogen atom and one oxygen atom. But a new study provides further chemical proof that the moon holds molecular water even in sunlit areas. Well, using data from the Stratospheric Observatory for Infrared Astronomy, or SOFIA, airborne telescope, researchers scanned the lunar surface at a more precise wavelength than had been used before, 6 microns instead of 3. And this allowed them to unambiguously distinguish the spectral fingerprint of molecular water, said co-author Casey Honeyball of the Hawaii Institute of Geophysics and Planetology. Well, researchers believe the water might be trapped in glass beads or another substance that protects it from the harsh lunar environment, Honeyball told Agence France-Presse, adding that further observation better be inundated when the water may have come from and how it is stored. If we find the water is abundant enough to certain locations, we may be able to use it as a resource for human exploration, Hannibal had said. It could be used as drinking water, breathable oxygen, and rocket fuel. A second study looks at areas of the moon's polar region where water is water ice is believed to be trapped in lunar craters that never see sunlight. So large hollows had previously been discovered. NASA in 2009 found water, the evolution so we can move on to other things if we can move on to the next page. So, good. One moment here. Okay. So, NASA, which plans to establish a space station in the lunar orbit called Gateway, envisages that ice excavated from the moon's south pole may one day supply drinking water, and they could also split the molecules apart to make rocket fuel for an onward journey. Now, that's very, very intriguing, to say the least. Now, let's look at some other issues that have come before us. Let's just quickly look and see what's happening in Europe. Anything in particular that we haven't already covered? All right. Well, nothing specific to Europe that we haven't already covered. Bear with me a moment here. And I'm going to move on to a different front. Let's quickly go over and see what's happening. Well, some new news out of the Ivory Coast, and I wanted to cover Africa. Evidently, the Ivory Coast has voted. A popular president has turned a controversial contender. And it seems that Ivory Coast President Alassane Ouattara, who is running for re-election in the October 31st presidential election, has been a fixture of Ivorian politics for 30 years. However, his candidacy has proved controversial, with critics saying it violates a two-term constitutional limit. So that's really outstanding work. Okay, so let's just quickly see what else is happening. So much on the world stage that's going on. It's amazing. Let's see what else is happening in the Middle East. Besides the boycott of the French. Okay, I think we covered all this stuff yesterday that took place in the Middle East, so we'll move on beyond that. Bear with me a moment here. Let's see what's happening here in the Americas. Well, this is frightening. A growing wildfire forces the evacuation of 60,000 people in Southern California. A fast-moving wildfire forced evacuation of 60,000 people in Southern California yesterday, as powerful winds across the state prompted power to be cut to hundreds of thousands to prevent utility equipment from speaking or sparking new flames. All right. Just see what else is happening here. Bear with me a moment. So many pages to go through. Bear with me a moment. Let's see if we can cover some other issues. Yeah, it seems the hopes of a U.S. stimulus deal were dashed as the Senate took a break for the election process. Hopes for an imminent agreement on a new stimulus plan for the U.S. economy have been dashed after the Senate was suspended until after next week's election. It remains unclear whether any agreement could be passed in the so-called lame duck period after the vote and before January's inauguration. So that's going to be very, very telling. And we'll see where all that goes. Now, let's look at some other issues. Bear with me a moment. Let's see what's happening in our hemisphere, the North and the Southern Hemisphere. You can hear. One second. This is interesting because I didn't think that this was still continuing, but I thought had it ended, but evidently not. Colombia has killed a top ELN guerrilla commander in a military operation. Seems that Colombian security forces have killed a top National Liberation Army ELN rebel commander known best by his nom de guerre Uriel during an operation in the coastal Pacific province of Chocó. President Iván Duque said on Sunday, Uriel, known for his media appearances, online videos, and one-time Twitter account, was responsible for kidnappings, the murder of human rights activists and members of the security forces, and forced recruitment of minors, Duque said in a broadcast with police and military leaders on Sunday evening. The terrorist Andrés Felipe Venegas Londono, who used the alias Uriel, has been downed, Duque said. This criminal was killed in a meticulous operation of shared intelligence by the National Army of Colombia and the National Police. Uriel used his social media to defend crime, Duque said, as he called for other ELN members to demobilize. The ELN, founded in 1964 by radical priests, are considered more radical and less centrally controlled than the FARC rebels, who signed a peace deal in 2016 and are now a legal political party. The ELN, which is about 2,000 fighters, began peace talks with the previous government, but negotiations fell apart after a where's a car bombing in Bogota, and Duque demanded that the guerrillas release all its hostages. Well, the government recently announced the capture of 8 rebels it accuses of taking part in the bomb attack, which killed 22 police office cadets in early 2019. So there's a lot of anger with these constant challenges of people all the time. Now, very, very interesting. We spoke to you about this yesterday, but it seems that Chileans have now been able to celebrate because there's the referendum is a clear win for rewriting the Pinochet-era constitution. Well, Chileans poured into the country's main square on Sunday night after voters gave a ringing endorsement to a plan to tear up the country's Pinochet-era constitution in favor of a new charter drafted by citizens. Santiago's Plaza Italia, the focus of the massive and often violent social protest last year, which sparked a demand for a new Magna Carta, Fireworks rose above a crowd of tens of thousands of jubilant people, singing in unison as the word rebirth, quote unquote, was beamed onto a tower above. With more than three quarters of the votes counted, 78.12% of voters had opted for a new charter. Many have expressed hopes that a new text will temper an unabashedly capitalist ethos with guarantees of more equal rights to health care, pensions, and education. And this triumph belongs to the people. It's thanks to everyone's efforts that we are at this moment of celebration, Danielle 37 told Reuters in Santiago's Plaza Nunua. What makes me happiest is the participation of the youth, young people wanting to make change. Chile's president, Sebastián Piñera, said that if the country had been divided by the protests and debate over whether to approve or reject plans for a new charter, from now on they would or should unite behind a new text that's provided a home people. And that's the end of the story. There's just a couple of more notes. Well, let me quickly look at all right, so let's just see what else is happening here. One second. All right, 1 minute. All right. Okay, we have an opportunity this time to move on to another front, and this has to do with Poland. It seems that the Polish Prime Minister is urging an end to barbarism of abortion and their protests. Poland's Prime Minister on Tuesday defended a highly controversial court ruling on abortion that has ignited angry protests across the country calling for an end to barbarism. Poland has seen six consecutive days of demonstrations against a decision which, when published, rule out abortions in all cases except rape and when the life of the mother is at risk. Acts of aggression, barbarism, and vandalism are absolutely unacceptable, Prime Minister Mateusz Morawiecki told reporters, warning that any violent protests could lead to an escalation. Attacks on religious symbols and churches will not be permitted, he said, after a series of protests in Catholic churches over the ruling. As the Prime Minister spoke, there was another protest, this time in the Polish parliament. Left-wing lawmakers held up placards and shouted pro-choice slogans in Jarosław Kaczyński, the powerful leader of the ruling Law and Justice Party. All right, so we'll have to see what else is happening on the world stage. Bear with me a moment. One moment here. All right, let me just see if I could find something else that's happening. I think we should be able to cover something in the stock market. Bear with me a moment here. Oh, yeah, here it is. Evidently, the Chinese economy has bounced back with a 4.9% growth in the third quarter. So China reported a 4.9% gross domestic product growth between July and September, making it the only major world economy that's starting to recover from its coronavirus slump. So meanwhile, in the United States, Republicans and Democrats are still struggling to agree on a stimulus bill before the presidential election. So that's going to be very, very interesting. So all right, now, you see what else we have here. This is very interesting with regard to business as well. The U.S. government has filed a landmark antitrust lawsuit against Google. The U.S. Justice Department is suing Google, accusing the giant tech company of running a monopoly on internet search markets, harming both consumers and competitors. And as a remedy, the government is seeking structural relief, anything from fines to a potential breakup of Google. Also, the World Economic Forum has bold new projections about automation and the future of work. So the group says half of all work tasks will be performed by machines by 2025, but new jobs will be created in fields like data, marketing, and robotics. It's 2025. That's unbelievable. It's now 2020, 5 years from now. Half of all work tasks will be performed by machines by 2025. That probably will mean that so many people will be displaced from working that we probably will have a universal basic income in order to be able to give people an opportunity to eat and to pay whatever bills they have to pay. And so this is going to be very, very telling. And so all of this is going to happen over the next 5 years. Very, very exciting on the one hand, and we'll see how this is going to be put into force and how quickly the economy can move on such a broad front. It'll be really, really fascinating, to say the least. I didn't expect that it would be this quickly. I expected that it would take place, but not within 5 years. My God, that's truly amazing. Well, it's not even 5 years. We're almost to 2021, so we're looking at 4 years hence. That so many new jobs will be automated. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Very, very interesting to see how all that's going to come to play. Let me go over to see what's happening in the Middle East. There's always something happening there. No, actually, I think we covered all of that. I didn't cover this. Bear with me a moment. Yeah, it seems that thousands of Iraqis have taken to the street to mark the anti-government protest anniversary. It seems that thousands of protesters took to the streets on Sunday to mark 1 year since mass anti-government demonstrations swept Baghdad and Iraq south, sparking calls to end rampant corruption. While protesters marched in the capital and several southern cities, including Najaf, Nasiriyah, and Basra, to renew demands proclaimed a year ago to bring an end to corruption by politicians. Mustafa Hussein, in his 20s, participated in the demonstrations last year and returned to Baghdad's Tahrir Square on Sunday. He said little had changed. Our demands that we wrote with the blood of our martyrs are still on the list of officials without implementation, he said. More than 500 people were killed during the months-long movement that began last year. Many of them protesters shot by Iraqi security forces who used live ammunition and tear gas to disperse crowds. In some cases, tear gas canisters struck the heads of demonstrators, killing them instantly. So, situation there. And unfortunately, not any movement forward. It's truly amazing the power of government that is so dismissive of the public interest. It's amazing. Truly amazing. Now, let's just quickly look and see what else. All right, let me just quickly look and see if we have anything else here to talk to you about. Yeah, we haven't covered much of what's going on in Asia. This is very interesting because I didn't expect this. It seems that there's a spate of farmer suicides in India. So let's listen to this report. This report comes from Florence Van Katt. They claim that agriculture is the largest employer in India, with nearly 50% of the country's workforce employed in it in one form or another. But the crucial sector is reeling from a spate of farmer suicides, many of the highest rates in the world. And the Franz Van Katt correspondent reports from Punjab, India's breadbasket, and one of the worst affected states, to find out what's behind this tragic phenomenon. Now, so let's move on into that, to that issue, and then we'll see what's going on. This is about a 5-minute report, so bear with me a moment.
This village in the northern state of Punjab was home to Sardar Jasveer Singh, his wife Sarabjeet, and their two children. He subsisted as a wheat and cotton farmer, barely earning enough from his small patch of land to feed his family. But in 2015, their lives unraveled.
He committed suicide. But less than 1 hectare of land, we didn't have enough. We bought a tractor and faced losses with our crops. And he was depressed after that. We had also taken out a loan of almost 4,000 euros to clear previous loans.
The mounting burden of debt became too much for Jasveer, and he hung himself in one of the rooms in their house. This case is not unique. Debt plagues more than half of India's 90 million farming households, and collectively, they owe banks and opportunistic moneylenders millions of euros. Since 1995, at least 300,000 farmers have killed themselves. And a majority of all those suicides were debt-related. Sarabjeet struggles to make ends meet, especially with an ailing child. And she still has the loans to repay.
We somehow make ends meet by selling fodder and milk. But wives of farmers aren't supposed to go out to work.
Kiranjeet Kaur lost her farmer father to suicide. Her organization provides support to women like Sarabjeet and helps them claim compensation from the government.
Hello. Women are going through major problems. It's a long battle.
When India witnessed its green revolution in the mid-1960s, food production multiplied and farmers got richer. But the gains would prove to be short-lived. High-yield seeds, heavily dependent on chemical fertilizers and pesticides, forced farmers to invest more and more money each year. Unseasonal rain and long periods of drought further exacerbated the misery of farming families.
The main causes for farmer suicides, one is that rising cost structures of agriculture, seed and fertilizer prices, particularly with the deregulation of those markets, are much higher. At the same time, the prices, the higher prices that are expected from the markets are not always realizing. All of this leading to a squeeze in income for farmers and therefore leading to rising indebtedness.
Most farmers sell their produce at wholesale markets like this one. The government sets prices here, but they remain low. Consumers benefit, but farmers don't.
I can't sleep because we're not getting our full rates. We owe money to the landlord and the bank. Farmers wouldn't have to ask banks for loans if we got the proper pay rates for our crops.
Just last month, the government unveiled reforms it said would increase productivity and farm incomes. The reforms seek to loosen rules that have kept farmers protected from free markets for decades. This set off a maelstrom of protests by farmers. They accuse the government of making things worse for them by leaving them at the mercy of private players. The government insists their reforms will give farmers greater choice.
A few days ago, this country freed its farmers from a lot of constraints. Now farmers can sell their produce anywhere and to anyone.
Back in Punjab, Kiranjit Kaur, the activist fighting for the widows of suicide victims, is at the forefront of the protest.
I think if the central government had been sensitive towards farmers' issues, they wouldn't have behaved like dictators, bringing in these bills unilaterally. They're trying to give away our lands to corporations.
As these debates rage on, experts believe India needs to overhaul its farming practices. This farm close to Delhi provides an alternative sustainable model. After 10 years of conventional agriculture, Ujjal Dagar's family switched to organic farming.
This is pure organic rice. We got seeds from home, so we don't have to buy seeds from outside. If we had used chemical fertilizers, it would have cost us 170 euros per half hectare of land. But this is 100% organic, and we're saving all this money.
Only 3% of India's cultivable land is currently dedicated to organic production.
Our farmers are not educated. We need to give them proper training. The government is not invested in organic farming. Where government schemes exist, they don't reach farmers. That is the biggest challenge today.
India urgently needs to oversee a shift towards sustainable modes of production. Otherwise, the future of nearly 50% of India's workforce looks bleak.
Wow. That's amazing. What amazing. You really wonder why it takes so long to put these things forward. It's truly amazing. One second. Let me see. This turns out be very interesting. Afghan forces have killed a top al-Qaeda militant wanted by the United States. So his name is Abu Musin al-Masri, an Egyptian national believed to be the group's number two in the Indian subcontinent, who was targeted in eastern Ghazni province. Listen to this report. One second.
Key member of al-Qaeda's central leadership dead in Afghanistan. The country's national security directorate says Abu Musin al-Masri was killed by Afghan special forces in the central province of Ghazni. Al-Masri, an Egyptian national, was also on the American FBI's most wanted terrorist list, charged with providing material support and resources to foreign terrorists and conspiracy to kill U.S. nationals. At American-led peace talks between the Afghan government and the Taliban in Doha last month, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said that fewer than 200 al-Qaeda operatives remain in Afghanistan. Those talks were sparked by a peace deal between the U.S. and the Taliban in February. In it, the Islamist militant group agreed not to let foreign extremists use Afghan territory. harboring of al-Qaeda leaders responsible for the September 11th terror attacks was a key reason for America's 2001 invasion of Afghanistan, an invasion that toppled the Taliban government but failed to destroy the organization, leading to nearly two decades of bloody internal conflict.
Wow, amazing stuff. You know, it's tough here, but it's tough all over. Amazing, really amazing. Especially when you look around one moment here. I'm going to move on to one of the places in the Orient. This is interesting because it's about Thailand, and we'll see if okay, listen to this report. I think you'll find it truly fascinating. Bear with me a moment.
I'm Dai Loma, and today I'm doing the Watch Shot Watch Challenge.
One second. All right. One second. We're going to get started right now.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of Access Asia. Here's what's coming up in today's show. Profiting from a protest movement, small businesses in Thailand use social media to help anti-government demonstrators and to benefit from the movement. Also coming up, the tragedy of farmer suicides. We investigate why Indian agricultural workers are taking their own lives. And Singapore becomes the first country in the world to roll out facial recognition technology. But is it safe? We start our program then in the Thai capital, Bangkok, which has been convulsed for weeks now by anti-government protests. Social media has been vital to the protest movement, not just to organize the demonstrations themselves, but also to help small businesses who come up with innovative ways to both support and benefit from the street movement. Catherine Khadir Clifford explains.
They're known as the CIA for the intelligence gathering that gets them to protest nights, not only before police, but before many of the protesters themselves.
We follow the protest news on every page, on every channel. We read the comments and everything.
Bangkok's street food vendors are ready to move in an instant as protest groups announce their sites at the last minute. To keep police off their trail, the information spreads across the city via a WhatsApp group named CIA Mobile Fishbowls for protests. Some say they doubled their income by attending the demos.
At the protest sites, you sell out faster than usual. Before, I'd head home around midnight. Now I can head home as early as 8 p.m.
This protester is glad to see the street vendors benefiting from the social movement. This is how it should be. Anywhere there's a protest, the economy flourishes. People need to eat so that they will have the strength to keep shouting. It's a risky environment for business, but the economic impact of the pandemic has left the vendors with little choice.
I'm scared, but I got used to it. I've been coming to every protest, so I'm used to it.
Meanwhile, on Twitter, a different kind of information is circling around the protests. An account is helping to link up protesters to hotel beds after the government brought in an emergency decree cracking down on those sleeping outside government buildings. Over 50 hostels across Bangkok have since opened their doors to activists.
We have hosted around 500 people since we started the campaign. Protesters are staying in different hostels, and each place has taken a lot of people.
Here, as well as a bed, they're given three meals per day and transport to protests. Individual supporters also joined the campaign, offering to donate to pay for hostel beds. I felt bad for those who didn't have a place to stay, because to me, no one should endure this kind of thing. So I posted on my Twitter offering free hostel stay with my own money that I collected from selling things online. Bangkok's hostels have been almost empty of foreign tourists since April, when authorities shut Thailand's borders to most commercial flights to contain the coronavirus.
go to India for you now, where our reporters have been investigating the tragic rise in suicides by farmers. Agriculture is one of the most important sectors in the Indian economy and employs nearly 50% of the Indian workforce. But millions of farmers are plagued by debt, and some simply find the pressure too much. Our team reports now from the state of Punjab, one of the worst affected in the country.
For over 20 years, this village in the northern state of Punjab was home to Sardar Jasbir Singh, his wife Sarabjit, and their two children. He subsisted as a wheat and cotton farmer, barely earning enough from his small patch of land to feed his family. But in 2015, their lives unraveled.
He committed suicide. With less than 1 hectare of land, we didn't have enough. We bought a tractor and faced losses with our crops. And he was depressed after that. We had also taken out a loan of almost 4,000 euros to clear previous loans.
The mounting burden of debt became too much for Jasbir, and he hung himself in one of the rooms in their house. This case is not unique. Debt plagues more than half of India's 90 million farming households, and collectively, they owe banks and opportunistic moneylenders millions of euros. Since 1995, at least 300,000 farmers have killed themselves. And a majority of all those suicides were debt-related. Sarabjit struggles to make ends meet, especially with an ailing child. And she still has the loans to repay.
We somehow make ends meet by selling fodder and milk. But why the farmers aren't supposed to go out to work?
When India witnessed its green revolution in the mid-1960s, food production multiplied and farmers got richer. But the gains would prove to be short-lived. High-yield seeds, heavily dependent on chemical fertilizers and pesticides, forced farmers to invest more and more money each year. Unseasonal rain and long periods of drought further exacerbated the misery of farming families.
The main causes for farmer suicides, one is that rising cost structures of agriculture, seed and fertilizer prices, particularly with the deregulation of those markets, are much higher. At the same time, the prices, the higher prices that are expected from the markets are not always realizing. All of this leading to a squeeze in income for farmers and therefore leading to rising indebtedness.
Most farmers sell their produce at wholesale markets like this one. The government sets prices here, but they remain low. Consumers benefit, but farmers don't.
I can't sleep because we're not getting our full rates. We owe money to the landlord and the bank. Farmers wouldn't have to ask banks for loans if we got the proper pay rates for our crops.
Just last month, the government unveiled reforms it said would increase productivity and farm incomes. The reforms seek to loosen rules that have kept farmers protected from free markets for decades. This set off a maelstrom of protests by farmers. They accuse the government of making things worse for them by leaving them at the mercy of private players. The government insists their reforms will give farmers greater choice.
A few days ago, this country freed its farmers from a lot of constraints. Now farmers can sell their produce anywhere and to anyone.
Back in Punjab, Kiranjit Kaur, the activist fighting for the widows of suicide victims, is at the forefront of the protests.
I think if the central government had been sensitive towards farmers' issues, they wouldn't have behaved like dictators, bringing in these bills unilaterally. They're trying to give away our lands to corporations.
As these debates rage on, experts believe India needs to overhaul its farming practices. This farm close to Delhi provides an alternative sustainable model. After 10 years of conventional agriculture, Ujjal Dagar's family switched to organic farming.
This is pure organic rice. We got seeds from home, so we don't have to buy seeds from outside. If we had used chemical fertilizers, it would have cost us 170 euros per half hectare of land. But this is 100% organic, and we're saving all this money.
Only 3% of India's cultivable land is currently dedicated to organic production. India urgently needs to oversee a shift towards sustainable modes of production. Otherwise, the future of nearly 50% of India's workforce looks bleak.
Our facial recognition technology is becoming increasingly common, featured on smartphones and in airport security. But Singapore is on the verge of vastly expanding its use, putting verification by face at the heart of its national ID scheme. The government says the move will simplify life for millions of people, but privacy experts are concerned. Jean-Emile Jemine has the story.
Do away with having to remember all your passwords, access your bank accounts, your taxes, even visit your closest government agency just by using your face. It's the future that awaits Singapore as the country gears up to become the first in the world to use facial verification in its national ID scheme, SingPass.
We want to have assurance that the person behind the device is a real person. It's a person who we claimed who he is. And there's not an image or a video.
Facial verification has already been adopted in various forms around the world, such as unlocking phones and making payments. Governments have also deployed it at airports for security checks on travelers. But Singapore's rollout is one of the most ambitious yet, and the first to attach facial verification to a national identification database. The technology captures a series of photos of a person's face in various lights, with the images then matched against other data, such as national ID cards, passports and employment passes already in the possession of government. For privacy advocates, however, many ethical questions behind the technology remain.
We have to be very cautious about whether consent is genuinely, you know, informed and freely given in these kind of contexts. Stick with the power imbalance between yourself and
okay.
Government, but also between people and the institutions like the banks and others using this kind of technology.
But creators of the scheme GovTech are quick to point out that facial verification, unlike recognition, is consensual.
It is different from face recognition, which is used, for example, in surveillance. Right. So the big difference between these two is that face verification is an intentional process. It requires the users to present themselves, okay, to provide consent.
Furthermore, GovTech has stressed that no data will be shared with third parties, and SingPass users will be left with other options, such as personal passwords, to access services. At its final stages of completion, the technology is being trialed now at several government offices, as well as Singapore's largest bank, DBS.
Well, we are nearly at the end of the show, but there is just time to meet the teenager who may be the tallest in the world. Ren Keiyu from China's Sichuan province is only 14 years old, but he's already 7 feet and 3 inches tall. He towers above the other kids in his class, so Ren's parents were initially worried his height may have been something to be concerned about. But after getting the medical all clear, Ren spoke to the Guinness Book of Records, who then traveled to his hometown to formally measure his dimensions. And the winner of the world's tallest teenager will be announced in London in November. Well, that's it for Access Asia this week. Thank you very much for watching, and we'll be back at the same time next week.
France 24 brings you live coverage of the American presidential election. In 6 of the key states, our special correspondents on the ground meet with some of the people who will decide the outcomes. Watch their reports from North Carolina to Georgia, Florida, Arizona, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania on France 24. From remote parts to major cities, American views help you better understand today's United States. On Election Day, November 3rd, we'll be broadcasting simultaneously across all our channels, with our special correspondent covering the final hours in the race to the White House. Non-stop live coverage, following and analyzing results as they come in. Experience this historic event live on France 24's channel in French, English, Arabic and Spanish, as well as on our websites and mobile applications.